The race in one of the country's largest congressional districts has two new entrants, neither new to politics. The results could hinge on cash.
National money is going to be the dominant factor in this race. It may end up being the most expensive congressional district in the country.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, Arizona's SB 1070 is still in court. We'll get an update. Several Arizona mayors head south of the border, helping moms succeed in breastfeeding. And these are the sounds of national parks.
If you stop walking and you sit down for 20 minutes and you don't talk and you just listen, you start to realize how much you're hearing. Like, everything is making sound.
Plus, reclassifying Arizona's high school sports and sharing the road. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. What you see outside right now is likely what we can expect for the rest of the afternoon. Still could see some more rain, more thunderstorms before the day is out. Look for a high of 81 degrees. Partly cloudy tonight, 30% chance of showers and storms, overnight lows below 70. And then partly sunny skies tomorrow, very slight chance for some showers and storms and a high of 87. It's only 70 degrees right now at KJZZ. And in Valley traffic, be aware of flooding, lots of accidents because of the wet conditions. Among them, there's flooding on I-17 southbound at Northern, a collision I-17 southbound at Peoria that blocks the HOV lane, and a collision I-10 eastbound at 91st Avenue. One of Arizona's top regulators says he will not recuse himself from voting on how the state's largest utility charges customers with rooftop solar. KJZZ's Will Stone has more.
Commissioner Bob Stump is not backing down from any rate-making decisions on solar net metering and APS. Last month, solar company Sunrun requested Stump be removed from that because of alleged bias against the industry. Its motion cited social media posts, a letter, and even a short story written by the commissioner, in which a character of his calls net metering a, quote, subsidy. But in a strongly worded response, Stump rebuffed those accusations, saying the solar industry has misconstrued what was satire and confused many of the net metering issues. The solar rooftop industry is, quote, populated by Victorian fan wavers yearning for a fainting couch, wrote Stump. Recently, APS said it may withdraw its bid to raise rates on rooftop solar. The commission has recommended that issue be addressed next year. Will Stone, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The race for Arizona's first congressional district has gotten a bit more crowded. Two candidates Monday entered the contest for the Republican nomination for one of the country's biggest districts, Pinal County Sheriff Paul Babiou and Arizona House Speaker David Gowan. For more on this race and its new entrants, I'm joined by political consultant Stan Barnes, president of Copper State Consulting.
I think the Republican Party believes that District 1 is going to be a Republican congressional seat in Arizona. I also think the national Republicans think it's a winnable seat and a net pickup for the Republicans. So this is going to get a lot of attention, which means a lot of money, and is attracting some quality candidates.
How do you think these two new candidates sort of influence the race, which already has two Republicans running in the primary, Gary Keeney, who ran 2 years ago in this district, and a former Secretary of State, former Senate President, former gubernatorial candidate Ken Bennett?
I think the Republican lineup is really impressive. Ken Bennett is a wonderful person with a great track record of public service and a political root system in the Prescott area. Paul Babiou has got a winning hand. He has played in Pinal County part of the district. And David Gowan has done himself very well in a very short time in political scale as a leader in the State House and as a recognized political figure from Cochise County. You throw in Gary Keeney, who is lesser known and doesn't have a political track record, really, but does manage to have his own money to spend, which becomes an important factor in congressional politics. And you've got, you know, three or four candidates there that are the kind of people that can win that race. They reflect very well what the rural part of Arizona looks like and thinks like.
Well, in a district that big and that rural with as many diverse communities, rural communities as this district has, do one of the candidates have an advantage based on where their sort of center of influence and power is over the others?
I think it's fair to say that each candidate rightly claims their own geographic vantage. And I give that to all of them. But nobody's from the whole district because it is so spread out. So everybody has their own advantages. What is going to be critically important, which is always critically important, is how you reach out to voters. And do you have the money that it takes to buy the media to talk to voters? You can't win the race by going to town halls. You can win the race by being in voters' mailboxes and on their television screens and their computer screens with messages about why you are the right candidate. And all the Republicans are going to be scrambling for money in this primary to first explain why they're the best Republican and then into the general for the broader electorate. I think one of the big dynamics here is that national money is going to be the dominant factor in this race. It may end up being the most expensive congressional district in the country because the Democrat versus Republican thing is in play. It could go either way. And there aren't that many of those nationally.
Stan Barnes is president of Copper State Consulting. Stan, thanks.
Thanks. Thanks, Mark.
It's hard to believe, but 5 years after Arizona passed its immigration enforcement law, SB 1070, it's still being litigated in the courts. After a federal judge struck down some portions of the law and upheld others in September, both sides are appealing to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. With me now is KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block to explain. And Jude, I've got to be honest, we've heard so much news over the years about courts striking down or upholding various parts of SB 1070. I honestly didn't realize this case was still going on today. Why is it dragging on for so long in the courts?
Yeah, it's been 5 years of litigation at this point. And one of the reasons maybe why it's been so confusing is because there were two different legal challenges to the law. One was the U.S. federal government challenging portions of the law, arguing it preempted federal law. And that was the case that went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. There was a ruling in June of 2012 in that case. Three provisions were struck down, and another was allowed to take effect. And that's the one that requires law enforcement to verify immigration status if law enforcement has a reason to believe someone they stop is in the country illegally.
Which is the provision that opponents have dubbed the show me your papers or papers please provision.
Exactly. And that's central to the litigation that's still going on today, because in addition to the U.S. government's case, there's a separate legal challenge brought by a coalition of organizations. And they use some different legal arguments in their challenge. They're arguing the lawmakers who passed the law were motivated by racial animus, so the whole law should be tossed out. And this so-called papers please provision in particular, they've been arguing it discriminates against Latinos and Mexicans.
And in September, U.S. District Court Judge Susan Bolton issued an important ruling. What did she find?
Well, Bolton's September ruling was mixed. She decided to allow two of the provisions to go forward, the one we're discussing, this so-called show me your papers, as well as another that allows local law enforcement to transport suspected unauthorized immigrants to federal agencies. But she permanently struck down two other provisions that were aimed at limiting day labor activity on the grounds that they violated the First Amendment. And now both sides are appealing that ruling for the portion that they lost.
So Arizona is also appealing this?
Right, because they lost the day labor provisions. And what's interesting is that Arizona was the first state to pass this kind of sweeping immigration law, and other states followed Arizona's lead, but we're the only ones who are still left litigating. Some of these other states have managed to reach settlements where they've made agreements about limitations, whereas here we're still going in Arizona.
And Jude, this ruling kind of goes against the tide of other rulings that we've seen, especially on SB 1070, right?
Right. I mean, there's not a whole lot of SB 1070 left. A lot of the law has been gutted at this point. And we've seen a lot of immigration rulings go against Arizona. I mean, because Arizona's passed many immigration laws beyond SB 1070, and many have been struck down in the courts. The state human smuggling law is no longer in effect. Proposition 100, which denied bail to immigrants charged with certain felonies, which meant they had to stay in jail until their trial date, and driver's licenses for Dreamers, the attempt by the state to deny them driver's licenses, that's been struck down, allowing them to have driver's licenses. So we've really seen a trend away from Arizona's immigration enforcement, but this ruling was really it was mixed, and there were some victories and losses on both sides.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe-Blanc. Jude, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Six Arizona mayors are in Mexico this week as part of a trade mission aimed at opening up commerce. But the real mission may be to foster trust and understanding between the cities and the nation. KJZZ's Phil Latzman joins us with more. And Phil, we've seen this type of mission before, so what makes this one different?
Well, Mark, this time it's a unified effort. Mayors from Phoenix, Surprise, Tucson, Nogales, Yuma, and Mesa have made this journey south of the border, part of a coalition of municipal leaders who are trying to put the state's tarnished SB 1070 image behind them. On the line with us from Mexico City is Mesa's Mayor John Giles. Mayor Giles, what do Mexico and Mesa have in common?
You know, the longer I'm in Mexico, the more I feel at home. I think Mexico City and Mesa, Arizona are similar in a lot of ways. First of all, we've got a lot of great Latinos and in our community. They're an important part of our community. They're becoming a bigger and bigger part of our community. And it's important that there be a strong relationship between the state of Arizona and Mesa and Mexico, particularly. They're a great trading partner, but we also have a lot of opportunity for cultural exchanges. Really, I think it's important that we talk to one another and communicate so that we can dispel rumors that are out there that Arizona might be less than welcoming when it comes to trading with Mexico.
Is that something that you hear while you're south of the border talking to Mexican leaders, that Arizona is still not a place that is considered welcoming?
You know, I'm afraid so. I just came from a program where I was joined with five other mayors, and we were speaking at the leading university in Mexico City, and it was a question and answer forum with students, and that was a recurring theme. I think there still is some perception, there still is a strong perception that Arizona, you know, has a chip on the shoulder when it comes to trading with and interacting with people from Mexico.
So when it comes to trading and this business relationship, what can Mesa get from Mexico and what can Mexico get from Mesa when it comes to doing business?
You know, Mexico is very important to the Mesa economy. They're a large economy. They're our largest trading partner. Mexico is actually heavily invested in the aerospace industry. A lot of manufacturing of aerospace parts occur in Mexico, and a lot of those end up, back in Mesa, Arizona, where they are incorporated into helicopters, either at MD Helicopter or at the Boeing facility. They're also big on medical devices, as is Mesa. So our economies are very similar, and there's opportunity to expand that and to increase the trade that goes on between Mexico and the city of Mesa.
You are among a group of mayors, a bipartisan group, we should say, that have traveled to Mexico City this week. How important is it as a statement to do this all together as a region, as opposed to just one of you? Or I know Governor Ducey's been there, but having all of you there united together. How important is that?
You know, we've heard everywhere we went how impressed the folks that were visiting were that there was a group of six mayors from Mesa from Arizona traveling together. It does, as you say, send a strong message that as a region, we are very interested in Mexico, that we value our relationship, and that we're interested in increasing and improving our relationship with them, particularly when it comes to the economy. So we've heard that everywhere we go is the combined efforts of having everyone together with singing from the same sheet of music, I think, is doing a lot of good.
Mesa Mayor John Giles joining us from Mexico City. Mr. Mayor, thanks for your time. Good luck with the mission.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Coming up, big changes are on the way for high school sports in Arizona.
Last year, it was a three-prong criteria that included enrollment, percentage of kids on free and reduced lunch program, and past success.
But now it's all about a school's enrollment size. Details ahead on the show. Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. We could see some more rain before the day is out. Look for a high temperature of 81 degrees, 30% chance of showers and storms tonight, overnight lows in the upper 60s. Partly sunny tomorrow, slight chance of showers and storms and a high of 87. It's cloudy and 70 degrees right now at KJZZ. As you might expect with the weather today, lots of flooding, lots of collisions on the freeways. Among them, I-17 southbound at Cactus, that has the right lane blocked. I-17 southbound at Peoria, the HOV lane is blocked. I-10 eastbound at 91st Avenue, and flooding on the 303 southbound at Thomas. It's 2:20.
KJZZ is supported by the 55th Annual Phoenix Greek Festival, October 9th through the 11th. Authentic Greek food, pastries, beers, wines, live music and dancing, a village market, and a kids' zone. PhoenixGreekFestival.org.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Mark Brody. Pay disparities, wealth disparities, the concentration of wealth in the top 1% of workers, it's easy to talk about and easy to get mad about. Politicians and economists talk about it all the time. Doing something about it? That's hard. But there may be something happening in California that could signal a national change in the disparities between the pay of men and women.
Disparities that have such a long history with deep cultural roots that there was something of a playful joke back in the 1949 film Adam's Rib. Here, Katharine Hepburn plays a lawyer up against her husband, Spencer Tracy, in a case involving gender equity. And Spencer Tracy wasn't very happy about the way things turned out in court or in his marriage.
This is basic. I'm old-fashioned. I like two sexes. And what is more, I suddenly don't like being married to what is known as a new woman. I want a wife, not a competitor. Competitor, competitor! If you want to be a big he-woman, go and be one, but not with me.
But this romantic humor of the 1940s has become a very real campaign issue. It's given birth to the legal and economic doctrine of comparable worth, and was something President Obama made very personal during his reelection campaign in 2012.
I've got two daughters. I want to make sure they get paid the same as somebody's sons for doing the same job. Very straightforward. Any confusion there?
There's plenty of confusion, in fact. The Obama daughters will leave the White House far short of any guarantee that their pay in the workforce will equal the men working alongside them. The Obama name might help Sasha and Malia, but for women with no presidential pedigree in the federal workforce, they can expect to make about 79 cents for every dollar men earn. Maybe they should move to California, where the just-signed Fair Pay Act may begin to clarify things. Here's the sponsor of the bill, AB 1354, Assemblyman Bill Dodd.
Women are head of household in 40% of the households. It's not just a gender problem. It's a family problem. It's a human problem. And essentially what 1354 does is this makes sure that in the state of California that we're going to practice what we preach.
The Fair Pay Act will allow employees to get and exchange information about their company's pay scales without repercussions. It will force employers to justify salary differences between men and women or take steps to equalize them. The law is one political consequence of a court case filed by a state employee, Aileen Rizzo, who sued after discovering she was paid $12,000 less than a colleague in the same department with considerably less training and seniority than she had. Her case is pending, but she believes the new law signed by Governor Brown is the writing on a wall that she says is finally coming down, and an end to the roadblocks that she and many other women have faced.
One of the major ones was my prior salary. When women hold their prior salary, they're holding something that's a, a burden to them. They're carrying it with them, especially when employers are consistently asking you, well, what did you make before? Well, what did you make before? The doors just closed as soon as I asked the question, why is there a discrepancy? And it was like a shuffle of trying to make sure that no one talked to me, that I would have absolutely no way to solve it internally in the organization itself.
Were you able to discover what the pay was of your colleague in a public manner, or did that require some investigation on your part?
No, it was public. He was sharing with someone else and was sharing it openly of what he had gotten on his first contract. And then the other males were quick to share it as well. And there has to be a way to create a salary policy that's based on your experience and education. Other county offices are doing that, and that's a much more fair way to pay someone and more valid, business-valid reason rather than just getting your previous salary.
Now, the law says that, and again, the previous salary law hasn't been signed yet, but this current law says that businesses can discriminate or can justify a different salary between a man and a woman as long as it's a non-gender-based reason that would include a seniority system, a merit system, earnings that demonstrate an individual's quantity of production or quality of production, or some kind of education, training, or experience. Now, how difficult would it be for a company to basically say, well, Joe over here is a genius. I mean, he's a college dropout, sure, but I mean, he has so many innovative ideas. We just had to take him, and that would be enough.
Well, that wouldn't be a valid, what I would consider a valid business reason. And really the burden is on now the employer instead of before it was on the plaintiff to try to prove that there was some equality there and that there was no reason to pay someone different. But now the burden is on them, and it has to be a really good business reason. It has to be something that's valid and has merit. It can't just be something like, oh, we like him better or we think he has great ideas. It really has to be something that's documented, real proof.
If the only solution because of economic problems, an economic opportunity a company might take, if the only solution in a company were to basically reduce the salary of all men to equalize it with women, how uncomfortable would that make it for you in your office if that was the solution or the scenario? I'm not saying it is, but if it were?
That would be a difficult thing. That would be. But my thoughts on this is that why pay for so much of this legal fees that they're going through to fight equal pay litigation that's against them? Why not just make it right? How much money are they spending on litigation when they could have just made it right to begin with? And if it's made right now, then that could be something that allows this to perpetuate and close the gaps for women.
And you have a stake in this in the sense that you have some employees on their way to the workforce in your own family. Aren't you worried that your daughters may go into the workforce and they'll look at your name and go, oh, you're the daughter of that rabble-rouser. What do you tell them about sticking up for the principal here?
I'm definitely not worried about that. I hope that they have a heritage of knowing that nothing is fixed. And if there's injustice, you can do something about it to make a difference. Lobbying and testifying for the California Pay Act was a distinct privilege. And I had no hope that it would help my case, but I knew that it would help others. Because isn't it enough if you discriminate against one person? How many people do you need to discriminate against for it to be wrong? So I'm ready to hold them accountable for that and see what happens.
She's a workplace activist, but she's also a math consultant for the Fresno County Office of Education. Aileen Rizzo, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has decided against listing the Sonoran Desert Tortoise on the endangered species list. That follows several years of review. One element of that is what's called a candidate conservation agreement. The Arizona Game and Fish Department is leading that effort. Thomas R. Jones is the acting non-game wildlife branch chief for the Arizona Game and Fish Department.
During the process of evaluating whether or not the tortoise needs to be listed under the ESA, many of us got together, many agencies got together, and agreed to put together what is called a candidate conservation agreement,
This is one of the conservation tools that the Fish and Wildlife Service makes available to have in one place conservation actions articulated for a particular species that might be in need of some sort of protection. Now, the Game and Fish Department does not think, and our data do not support listing tortoises, but that's a separate issue. What we do recognize is that tortoises need protection, although not under the Endangered Species Act, perhaps. So the Candidate Conservation Agreement brings together a whole bunch of agencies, typically federal agencies, but it does not have to be. The Conservation Agreement itself articulates exactly what those various entities or agencies are doing to conserve, protect, support Sonoran desert tortoises in Arizona.
What kinds of things have agencies like yours and others been doing over the years to try to protect and conserve these tortoises?
The department has conducted a lot of research that has been published in the primary literature about the biology of the tortoises so that we understand tortoises' needs in terms of habitat, food, and so forth. We've been monitoring tortoises for over 25 years throughout their distribution in Arizona to be able to tell if they are doing well or not.
Do you have a sense of how many Sonoran desert tortoises there are in Arizona right now?
No, we do not. We know that they're widespread. We know that their populations in general are doing well. They are abundant in good habitat, but there's absolutely no way of putting some sort of estimate on the population out there.
Have the threats to the tortoise changed over the two-plus decades that you've been tracking it?
Sure, I think they have. Certainly, as Arizona becomes more populated, there are more threats to tortoises, I think more at the local level. And what I mean by that is as cities expand, people go out to areas where tortoises occur. They may want to pick up a tortoise and take it home, even though that's illegal. Their activities might damage tortoises. Development might take tortoise habitat. But that's at the local level. It's not at the species level, meaning it's not impacting the species as a whole throughout its distribution. One of the other threats that has expanded over the last several decades has been invasive grasses like African buffel grass. That's a species of grass that is not native to the Sonoran Desert. It has covered large expanses of Sonoran Desert tortoise habitat. And the problem with buffel grass is that it carries fire, and the Sonoran Desert is not a fire-adapted ecosystem. So if fire sweeps through buffel grass stands, it changes the ecology of the area almost completely. And we view that as a serious threat to desert tortoises, as well as other plants and animals of the Sonoran Desert. And that's one of the big threats that we and the Fish and Wildlife Service and other partners agree is one of the most important threats to desert tortoises.
Thomas R. Jones is the acting non-game wildlife branch chief for the Arizona Game and Fish Department. We are talking about the agency's work with others on a candidate conservation agreement for the Sonoran Desert tortoise. As summer is winding down, so too is the bullfighting season in Spain, and some think the same could be said of bullfighting itself. The number of fights has fallen by a third in recent years, and that was before animal rights activists and their allies took power in local elections. The BBC's Neil Rizel reports from Spain's bull rings and ranches, where they're now fighting to keep an age-old tradition alive.
In a bright, tight, sequined suit, the matador cuts a striking figure. The animal could kill him at any moment. But, as usual, he does the killing. The scene is repeated thousands of times across Spain every year, but that's changing. The number of fights has fallen by a third in the last 5 years, and many towns are now talking about stopping bullfighting altogether. Matador Victor Barrio.
Sometimes, yes, it worries me. Banning bullfight means, of course, less work for us. Closed rings, etc. For example, Barcelona, he used to bullfight, but now he cannot.
Barcelona banned bullfighting 3 years ago. The new threat to bullfighting is being driven by people like this. Torture is Not Culture is the name of a campaign launched by a political party dedicated to animal rights. The campaign started during the recent economic crisis, which saw big cuts in public spending. Today, unemployment is still at 22%. And activists, such as Ramon Linaza, see this as an opportunity.
Just a few years ago, the people who concerned about bullfighting and about animal suffering in general were a tiny minority of activists. But many, many more people are understanding that we should not subsidize bullfighting, particularly in a time when we are suffering cuts in health, education, etc., etc.
In all your years of watching animal rights and of watching bullfighting, has the opposition against it ever been stronger?
It has never been as strong as now.
Evidence is in the ballot box. In May's municipal elections, many cities voted for left-wing parties and coalitions which oppose bullfighting. And some are employing a clever tactic. Rather than ban bullfights directly, they want to stop public funding on the festivals that often surround them.
Well, away from the blood and sand of the bullring are the polished parquet floors of Spain's minister for bullfighting.
Bullfighting is part of our culture since the 8th century. So you can tell it's something that is very close to the heart of the Spanish people.
Fernando Bento's proper title is Undersecretary for Education and Culture. He's right that bullfighting is close to the heart of some Spanish people. The question is, how close do they want it to their wallets? Mr. Bento is a member of the national government, but he seems powerless against the new tactic to end bullfighting at the local level.
If they cut the money, you have a problem, I have to admit that. I mean, if local government, which usually is the one that supports bullfighting, cut the funds, as national government, we can't do anything.
So it falls to those in the bullfighting world, the matadors, promoters, and breeders, to preserve their tradition.
So this is an extraordinary scene. The sun is coming through dust kicked up by 2 half-ton bulls.
These bulls will eventually fight matadors. We're on a ranch on a broad plateau far from Madrid, owned by Antonio Boyano.
He says the movement, anti-bullfighting movement, is really well organized. It seems it's stronger than ever. But on the other hand, on the opposite side, the pro-bullfighters, they are not organized. They are all spread. They take it for granted because it's been happening forever. So he thinks the pro-bullfighters should get out of the closet.
Bullfighting is not on its last legs. The same elections that brought so many anti-bullfighting parties to power brought one that overturned an earlier ban. The tradition runs deep, but it is caught on 2 sharp horns, a tough economy and a new politics.
That's the BBC's Neil Rizal in Spain. Still to come, breastfeeding rates are on the rise in the U.S., but many moms struggle with it.
If a mom says, I think I want to breastfeed for 6 months, but she's having trouble in the first 2 weeks, that can be really defeating as a new mom.
Helping moms be successful with breastfeeding. That's just ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix, along with Steve Goldstein. We're looking for the possibility of some more rain today with a high of 81 degrees, 30% chance of showers and storms tonight, overnight lows below 70, and partly sunny skies tomorrow, slight chance for more rain with a high of 87. It's 70 degrees at KJZZ. Be aware of flooding collisions on valley roadways because of the weather. Among them, I-17 southbound at Cactus, the right lane is blocked. I-17 southbound at Northern, there's flooding on the roadway. And the 51 southbound at Glendale. It's 2:37.
KJZZ is supported by Phoenix College Theater, presenting All in the Timing by David Ives through October 16th. Comedy and romance are included in this collection of one acts, which looks at time from different angles. phoenixcollege.edu/theater.
In KJZZ news, while the monsoon season in Arizona is officially over, residents may have noticed the rain hasn't gotten the memo. KJZZ's Casey Kuhn reports.
Climatologist at the University of Arizona, Mike Crimmins, says the wet weather this late in the season is a result of a strong El Nino. Crimmins says the resulting moisture may mean a good year for local flora.
We're kind of in that period of time right here in October that it could go either way, and it looks like it's going to go wet, which would favor the growth of a lot of these lower desert plants. It could be a good wildflower season on the heels of that in January and February.
Crimmins says the unusual weather conditions weren't unforeseen, but climatologists were hoping for drier weather to bring the temperatures down in the evening. This year's El Nino was felt last May, when early rains came before the dry summer. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Arizona Interscholastic Association, or AIA, has carried a lot of weight with its 272 member schools, including when it comes to scheduling games and matches. But individual athletic directors and administrators have decided to take back some of that power. So they've created six conferences, from 1A up to 6A, and are going to classify schools based on enrollment figures. Arizona Republic columnist Scott Bordeaux covers high school sports. And Scott, how is the role of the AIA changing?
It's interesting. They've kind of come full circle. You know, 10, 15 years ago, athletic directors basically made up the schedules, decided which teams would play in which conferences, made up the schedules of all the teams. The ADs would get together in a room. And over time, partly because it was getting difficult for some teams to get scheduled, some teams didn't want to play other schools, there was a lot of infighting, the AIA, which governs high school sports in the state, kind of took over the entire process. They started assigning which teams would be in conferences based on certain criteria. They did computer scheduling, and that's been going on for the last 3 or 4 years. But the athletic directors finally decided that they wanted to kind of have the power again. They wanted to decide which schools should be in which conferences. They wanted to make up their own schedules, and that's what happened in the recent legislative council meeting. So we've kind of come full circle from, say, 10 or 15 years ago.
So how does the AIA in the smaller level compare to, let's say, the power that the NCAA has for their colleges?
The AIA essentially governs high school sports. They make up the rules for schools. They determine eligibility if kids want to transfer. And in past years, what they've done is they've had a criteria for assigning schools to what conferences they play in. Last year, it was a three-prong criteria that included enrollment, percentage of kids on free and reduced lunch program, and past success. The idea being socioeconomics is such a big factor in high school sports that we're going to try to use some of those factors to properly place high school athletic teams. But that's now changed, and they're going to be just assigning teams strictly on enrollment.
Does it seem like people are looking out for their schools and the kids in a proper way? Did it seem like the AIA was more interested in that when you talk about the different levels of criteria there were?
Well, I think they were trying to do that with that three-prong criteria that was in effect this year and still is in effect for the rest of the school year. Because, you know, we all know, Steve, that enrollment is no longer a proper indicator of a program's athletic strength. You have a lot of schools with 3,000 kids, and because of demographics, socioeconomics, they just don't have a lot of kids going out for sports. So the AIA was trying to use this criteria to properly place, especially inner city schools that may have a lot of kids but very weak athletic programs. And in some cases, it's worked. But the athletic directors think that it caused too many appeals. There were over 500 last year. A school might have a football program in one conference, a swimming program in another, and they wanted all their teams to be in the same conference. This is going to be on the athletic directors. If this is going to work, they're going to have to take care of each other, not just of their own school, but they're going to have to take care of their less fortunate programs that are in their conference strictly by enrollment numbers, because that's what the new criteria is based on.
You wrote about trust, and I thought this was fascinating. Scott, who's worried about trusting whom at this point?
Well, let's use the Phoenix Union High School District as an example. There are 10 teams in the Phoenix Union High School District. Six of them, based on their enrollment numbers, will be placed in the 6A conference next year. That's the highest conference level. So they'll be playing the best programs in the state. Now, a lot of those six schools, maybe one could compete at the 6A level. The others have high enrollments, but they don't have a lot of kids going out. You know, for various reasons, as you see at a less affluent school, kids have to stay home to take care of their family, or you know they have to work jobs to help support their family, a lot of reasons. What we're looking at, those POHSD schools have to trust the athletic directors that are making up their schedules, that you're not going to schedule us against the toughest programs in 6A. If there's 30 programs in 6A, we're going to play the other lower-tier programs in 6A, and also you're going to schedule us against some 5A programs. And then the second part of this, Steve, is that if those schools in the PUHSD, Phoenix Union District, appeal down to 5A, which is the second largest conference, that the ADs on the appealing committee will say, we understand that even though you have a high enrollment, you can't compete at the highest level, so So we're going to allow you to appeal down. That's where the trust factor comes in.
Scott Bordeaux is a columnist for the Arizona Republic. Scott, thanks a lot.
All right, Steve.
The introduction of formula led many women to stop breastfeeding in the 1950s and 60s. It's taken decades, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say breastfeeding rates are on the rise. Although it's the most natural way to feed your baby, it can be extremely difficult. In a new report out today, the CDC takes a look at the pivotal role hospitals have in getting women started with breastfeeding, but also how crucial support is once women are home, citing the help of lactation specialists whose numbers per 1,000 live births have nearly doubled in less than a decade. KJZZ's Kate Sheehy, a breastfeeding mother herself, reports.
Sarah Hatton and her newborn baby boy are both in tears. Malachi was born with a tongue tie. That's when the cord connecting the tongue to the floor of the mouth is short and restricts mobility. He just had surgery to fix it, but now has to learn to suck.
For him, because he's not able to access her milk as efficiently as he needs to, he gets frustrated at the breast.
Chrissy Blake is a registered nurse and an international board-certified lactation consultant. She's also co-owner of Milk and Honey, a new breastfeeding support center in Tucson, Arizona. Blake shows Hatton how to use a supplemental nursing system. The baby drinks from a tiny tube attached to a bottle with formula or breast milk that's been pumped, while at the same time feeding at the breast.
So he's still getting your breast milk. He's getting a little bit of more flow, and he's getting additional calories here, which will help kind of increase his weight gain a little bit. While still stimulating your supply, is it okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just hard.
Yeah, I know. This is intended to make things easier.
The American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that babies be exclusively breastfed for about the first 6 months. CDC studies show that breastfed babies have a lower risk of getting asthma and intestinal infections, among other conditions, and moms who breastfeed have a lower risk for breast and ovarian cancers and heart disease.
Breastfeeding is really about supply and demand, and you have to sort of immediately start creating that demand and actually breastfeeding the baby so that then the milk supply will follow.
Kriya Perine heads the infant feeding team at the CDC. In a new report, the agency looks at breastfeeding support in hospitals. The data is from a survey of successful breastfeeding practices established by the World Health Organization and the United Nations Children's Fund. The CDC started the survey in 2007, sending it out to every birth facility in the country every 2 years. More than 80% have responded.
We know that a lot of women stop breastfeeding before they intend. And so that's where I think these professionals are really key to helping women starting breastfeeding.
Perine says hospitals have improved in several areas, such as initiating breastfeeding and keeping moms and babies together longer after delivery. But that support drops significantly after the moms leave the hospital.
I think my supply, I feel like, might be decreasing. I'm pumping at
This work. Is a weekly free breastfeeding support group at Tucson Medical Center. Over the last few years, the hospital has been implementing more breastfeeding-friendly practices, such as using formula only when medically necessary. And within the last few weeks, it's opened an outpatient breastfeeding clinic.
Because it's so frustrating to talk to them over the phone, and then you call them a day later, and things still haven't changed. And you know that if you could look at the latch, if you could just look at it, you could come up with different things that could help them.
Noreen Carver is a lactation consultant at the hospital. And the latch she's talking about is the way a baby's mouth connects to the mom's nipple in order to effectively get milk. Carver says now she'll be able to see more moms one-on-one. There's even financial assistance for women who have to pay out of pocket.
It used to be that you'd have your aunt, your grandma, your cousin, your sister to help you through breastfeeding in the beginning, but we don't have that infrastructure for breastfeeding at all. So I see us as that.
Back at Milk and Honey, co-owner Nina Isaac says breastfeeding may not work for every mom. And she says women don't need to feel ashamed if they choose formula.
We need to give informed consent. We need to give all the information. These are your options. You can pump your milk, or there's formula if you need it. It's there. It's not a bad word. It saved many a baby's lives.
In that first week as a new mom, getting up every few hours to breastfeed, I remember thinking, really? Can I do this? With the help of a lactation specialist, I found that it does get easier. I'm still breastfeeding my six-month-old. Kate Sheehy, KJZZ News, Tucson.
We'll be right back.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Chance of rain continues through the rest of the day today into tonight. 30% chance tonight. Look for overnight lows a little below 70. Partly sunny skies tomorrow. Slight chance of more rain and a high of 87. It's 70 degrees at KJZZ at 250.
KJZZ is supported by Sun Health Senior Living, a nonprofit provider of destination retirement communities with upscale dining, resort-style amenities, and numerous residence options. Information at sunhealthretirement.org.
Phoenix is trying to remind bicyclists to ride with traffic rather than against it, and remind drivers to watch out for cyclists who may be coming at them. The city has posted wrong-way signs on the backs of some street signs across Phoenix and messages on buses for drivers. Carrie Wilcoxon is the head of the Safety and Neighborhood Traffic Section for Phoenix's Street Transportation Department.
What we're trying to do is actually just remind people that if they're riding their bikes on the sidewalk specifically, that they watch out for traffic. In Phoenix, it's not illegal to ride your bike on the wrong way or on the sidewalk, and it's not illegal to ride on the wrong way or going the wrong way. But also in Phoenix, we know that about a third of our bicycle crashes in the most recent year we have data for were the result, or at least contributed in part, by a bicyclist who was riding the wrong way, either on the sidewalk or on the road. So what our campaign is aimed at is educating bicyclists that we know that it's sometimes not safe to, you know, cross the street and ride with traffic. But if you're going to ride the wrong way on sidewalks, make sure that you're watching out for pedestrians, make sure that you're watching out for other vehicles, and make sure that you're just aware of the situation around you.
And just to be clear, when you talk about going the wrong way, you're talking about riding your bike opposite traffic, right? Not going with traffic.
That's correct. A lot of people think that, and this is true for riding on the sidewalk as well as riding on the roadway, a lot of people think that it's actually safer to ride against traffic. I'm not entirely sure what the reasons for that belief are, but it may be just the fact that people feel safer being able to see vehicles coming at them. But our data shows that, in fact, law in many places says that it is not safer to ride against traffic, certainly on the street. And our data shows that riding against traffic on the sidewalk can create some very serious safety issues.
Well, given the fact that riding opposite traffic on your bike causes so many problems, wouldn't it make more sense just to make it illegal?
You know, some municipalities have, but in Phoenix, our belief is that we want people to be comfortable riding bicycles. And if the sidewalk is the place they feel comfortable on, or if that is the only option for them riding a bike, then we want them to be able to do that. But the other aspect to keep in mind is that a lot of times riding the wrong way is really the best option and the safest. If you, for instance, come to a street where on a bicycle, if you come to a street and you only have to go a couple of blocks, the decision would be to cross the street, cross however many lanes of traffic so that I can ride with traffic, and then cross back over again to get to my destination, or do I ride the wrong way on the street? And a lot of times people choose to ride the wrong way on the street. We recognize that. But we want them to just keep in mind that if they're going to do that, they need to be careful and aware of the situation around them, including the drivers of vehicles, including pedestrians. Just be alert.
Carrie Wilcoxon is the head of the Safety and Neighborhood Traffic Section for Phoenix's Street Transportation Department. We are talking about the city's effort to remind bicyclists to ride with traffic rather than opposite it. That's the sound of frogs in Sequoia and Kings National Parks in California. They were recorded as part of a project called Listen, which looks at the acoustic ecology of deserts across the Southwest. Garth Payne started it. He's a professor in the School of Arts, Media, and Engineering and the School of Music at ASU. Payne uses a format called ambisonic recording and has used the sounds he's collected to create a virtual reality experience of some of the region's parks.
I guess over the years, I've been very interested in the environment and the properties of listening to the environment. And we don't talk about that very often, but the idea that there's an acoustic ecology and there's an ecology that's grown up over millennia.
What's interesting, I think, is that for a lot of people, when they go to a national park or they go hiking in the wilderness, one of the things they'll tell you for why they do it is because it's totally quiet. I hear nothingness. Right. But it's not nothing. Even if you're in the middle of nowhere, there's still something that you're hearing.
Right. Right. So it's you're absolutely right. And in fact, if you stop walking and you sit down for 20 minutes and you don't talk and you just listen, you start to realize how much you're hearing. Like everything is making sound.
When you're out recording, are the sounds that you're hearing mostly man-made sounds? Are they airplanes going overhead or people walking or talking? Or are they sounds most identified with nature?
So I guess to some extent that depends where you go. But it's true that there's a lot of human-generated sound. So the human impact, even in the national parks that we work in across the Southwest, is substantial. So these are things that we haven't thought about very much. So there's a lot of this policy in place that looks at noise pollution, and these are absolute thresholds of noise. But what we're trying to do is to move that discussion away from kind of critiquing just the noise to thinking about the fact that that noise is introduced into an ecology.
Do you ever find yourself not knowing what something is that you're hearing when you're out recording?
Oh, all the time, because I'm not a biologist. So all the time I'm like, wow, that's an incredible sound. And in fact, can I tell you a sort of funny story?
Sure.
So I often go out and I like to record pre-dawn in, you know, through the dawn and then pre-sunset into the night. And so I was near a river lying down recording. It got dark, all the crickets came out and there were fish in the river and, you know, amazing sounds. Because when you're lying there with headphones on, you hear this incredibly hyper-reality. And I don't know, it was thoroughly dark and I started to hear these little whimpery sounds. And I'm lying there going, oh, that's such a cool sound. And I'm listening in surround sound. And so after over about 20 minutes, I start to realize that actually there are several of these little whimpery sounds and they're kind of around me. And so I don't like to move because it'll destroy the recording. And at one point I just went, well, I think I just need to move a little and see what happens. And so I rolled over onto my side and all hell broke loose because I was really surrounded by a bunch of coyotes who were clearly going, oh, he's still warm. That'll be tasty. And I had no idea what the sound was that I was hearing, but I was listening to it as a composer and as a sound artist and thinking, wow, that's a great sound.
So what are some of the favorite sounds that you've recorded over the years?
So certainly some of the bird calls are just extraordinary. And a few months ago, I was in Segoia and Kings Canyon National Park and was fortunate enough to hear a woodpecker drumming, which is part of a mating ritual. And they literally drum on a hollow part of a tree. You know, when you go out and you're just lying in the wilderness recording, amazing things happen. And so you get to have this kind of intimacy of engagement with sound that you wouldn't normally have because you're in this really active listening mode. And I think that leads also to the other thing that I find really interesting is that every place that you record, every landscape, has a kind of underlying sonic signature, which is this kind of property of the land itself without the events that are going on top of that. And if you listen actively enough and you're there long enough, you can really tune into this sonic signature of the landscape.
How do you hope that this project will be used? I mean, what's the overall goal of something like this besides having some of these incredible recordings?
Well, we're really interested in building environmental awareness. So, you know, our objective has actually been to build capacity and stewardship in the local communities. And so we do a lot of workshops in the communities and we want to raise awareness about how important the sonic signature of landscapes are and how actually they're a kind of talisman of change of human use, of climate change, of change in that landscape.
Garth Payne is a professor in the School of Arts, Media, and Engineering and the School of Music at ASU. He also started the Listen Project. What you're hearing, by the way, is an original composition of Payne's using sounds collected as part of the project. There will be a concert of this music on October 16th at the ASU Art Museum. And I'm joined once again by KJZZ's Steve Goldstein, host of this program, also host of KJZZ's Here and Now, tomorrow morning at 11. Steve, we've been talking a lot about K-12 funding, the various plans to do that. You'll be talking about one in particular tomorrow.
Yeah, Mark, there's a new report coming out, embargoed until tomorrow, which will tell us whether the plan by Governor Deuce is a good one or not. I think they're leaning toward good, but we'll talk about it tomorrow.
And that's the plan to basically tap the state land trust for more money into education.
Exactly. Somewhat controversial. Some are supporting, some are against.
Also, another big ongoing story of the contempt of court proceeding with Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. We'll be talking about that.
Exactly. We've heard from our great reporter, Jude Jaffe Block. But tomorrow, New Times columnist Steve Lemons, very opinionated on this topic.
That's KJZZ's Here and Now, tomorrow morning at 11. The show was produced by our senior producer, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revizova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer, news director Al Macias, executive producer John Hoban. This is member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks so much for listening. It's 3 o'clock.